Okay, we are now entering the third major section in our book on being Presbyterian. The book is divided into three sections: Presbyterian beliefs, Presbyterian practices, and Presbyterian stories. We've looked at beliefs and practices, and beginning this week, we're going to look at Presbyterian stories. And that is, we're going to be looking at church history, but particularly that aspect of church history that is somewhat uniquely Presbyterian, and that which is our heritage as Presbyterians. And so this chapter is entitled The Glorious Reformation, Calvin, Knox, and the Beginnings of Presbyterianism. I have a few quotes from the book on your handout. And Sean Lucas makes some pretty astonishing claims here. Without the Reformation, Europe would have been a thoroughly secular society by the end of the 17th century. He says a variation on that a couple times in this chapter. And what he points out is that the church at that time, coming into the 16th century, had become so corrupt and it was so entangled in politics that it was losing all of its spiritual vitality. And it was losing even the respect of those around it. And if those trends had continued unchecked, then the Roman Catholic Church likely would have, in some sense, very much diminished in its impact upon culture. The Enlightenment thought would come on the rise and would largely displace it. So at least from his perspective, he believes that if the Reformation had not reintroduced vitality into a large portion of the church, Europe might have been almost completely secularized by the end of the 17th century. Another quote here: if the Reformation had never happened, the rising capitalists of Europe would have led the secularization process with disastrous results for the continent's political and moral situation. The Reformation did much to make 16th century capitalism more compassionate. Not everyone takes that view. A lot of times the Protestant Reformation is looked at as sort of the engine for all that's bad about capitalism. But Lucas points out that you need but look to Calvin's Geneva. And in Calvin's Geneva, there was a great concern for the poor. There was a great concern for the sick. They formed hospitals. It was all under the oversight of the deacons. And it was financed pretty much by the contributions that people were making through the church. And yes, it was, capitalism was burgeoning. There was a growing middle class. But all of that was happening alongside this great exercise of compassion, largely again as a diaconal outreach of the church. And what took place in Geneva took place in various forms in other places. And it did provide something of a check against the excesses of capitalism. Imagine if there were not that Christian influence, if capitalism was completely unfettered by any of the dictates of conscience that would come through interaction with the church. Well, he suggests that, again, that secularization process would have been faster and more pervasive, and capitalism would be even worse than it is today. And admittedly, there's a lot of problems with somewhat unfettered capitalism, but the Reformation did much to make it more compassionate. Then he says, if the Reformation had never happened, then the gospel of free grace would have been overshadowed by the unreformed ritual and the malformed theology of the Roman Catholic Church. And of course, we think this is the heart of what was recovered at the Reformation, a recovery of the understanding of the gospel of God's grace. Because again, the church had been so corrupted, the people really didn't know better. They just went to observe. They would observe the priest doing the Mass in a Latin language that they didn't understand. They rarely partook at all, and they were not, for the most part, being fed. There were exceptions. There were some traveling preaching orders. There was some teaching that was taking place. But by and large, it was a church that was just in a very low spiritual state. And it had lost that understanding of the grace of God as the basis for our salvation. And again, the gospel of the Reformation, which proclaimed that God's righteousness shall come to those who live by faith alone, fundamentally challenged the basis of medieval religion. If salvation came by faith alone in Christ alone, and if this provided an effectual removal of religious guilt and anxiety, then the forms of penance that had proved so financially profitable for the church, particularly indulgences, were not only unnecessary, but blasphemous. And think of how liberating this was for the common man, who had been told, you know, by Johann Tetzel and others, that if you just give to the church, you will automatically reap spiritual results. You can buy your way into heaven. You can buy other people out of purgatory. And all this money was just flowing to Rome and filling the coffers of the church. That was fundamentally challenged by the insight that we're saved by grace alone through faith in Christ alone. No longer do we have to be buying our way to salvation. No longer do we need to be working our way to salvation. So it was a fundamental paradigm shift. And then Lucas remarks, out of this Reformation period that fundamentally transformed social, political, economic, and religious structures, Presbyterianism came into being. Now, I know that when I was away for a few weeks, Seth Drown had some videos looking at the Reformation with you. So I know you've had a recent kind of rehearsal of the history of the Reformation. We're going to look at three particular either persons or events that are important for Presbyterian history, for the development of Presbyterianism. And the two people are John Calvin and John Knox. And then the event, which involved a number of people, is the Westminster Assembly, the gathering of the Westminster Assembly. And that those were the three things that were focused upon in this chapter. And what I've done is I've provided on your outline a timeline, a little chronological listing of some of the key events relating to the life and work of Calvin, the life and work of Knox, and the Westminster Assembly. One of the things I like about doing something like this is sometimes you see where people line up against each other and how things were unfolding simultaneously. And what I'm going to do is really just walk through this timeline. But first of all, I'm going to focus on John Calvin. There's some overlapping with Knox. We'll do John Calvin. We'll come back. We'll look at Knox. And then we'll end up with the Westminster Assembly. So John Calvin was born in Noyon, France, in the year 1509. And just again, to keep things in perspective, John Knox was born 4 years later in Haddington, Scotland. So they were pretty close contemporaries. So 1509, Calvin is born. In 1516, there's a significant event in the history of the church, and indeed of culture, in that Desiderius Erasmus published the first critical edition of the Greek New Testament. Now this was this meant several things. The authoritative Bible that was used by the church was the Latin Vulgate. It had been translated largely by Jerome back in the, I think it's the late 4th, early 5th century. It was not the most accurate translation from Hebrew and Greek. At a number of points, it was kind of weak. So anytime there was any controversy of faith, if they appealed to Scripture at all, they appealed to this Latin translation. They did not go back to the original Greek or the original Hebrew. And the weaknesses within the Vulgate were something that would limit them and that would hinder them. Erasmus was part of a growing humanist movement. Now, often when we hear the word humanist, we think, oh, that's bad, right? Because back in the 70s and 80s, we were all warned about secular humanism. And secular humanism is you start with man. Man is the be-all, end-all. And there's really no place for God. There's no place for faith. And we were warned that secular humanism was taking over the culture. And that wasn't a completely unwarranted warning. And we still battle with secular humanism. But historically, in the early 16th century, humanism was sort of a revival of learning. And one of their sort of cries, it became a cry of the Reformation, but it really grew out of the humanist education movement, was this move ad fontes back to the fountains, back to the original sources. And this was something that was taking place across disciplines. So there was a rediscovery of some of the Greek philosophers that had been sort of neglected, and people were studying their works in Greek. And there was, on the religious side of things, a desire to get back to the sources. And when that's the Bible, that means you need to go back before the Vulgate Latin translation, and you need to look at the original Greek and the original Hebrew. That's the closest we can get to what God has given us. And so in 1516, Erasmus published the first critical edition of the Greek New Testament, which means he examined a number of manuscripts. Now, we have a lot more manuscripts in our day than he did or that he had access to, but he did a very good job exploring those different ones, finding out little differences here and there, and trying to determine on the basis of good criteria what's the best text of the Greek New Testament. And so that was a very important point in the development of biblical studies and the development of theology. And this was when Calvin was really young. I mean, he was 7 years old. But what happened was, as he grew and as he went off to education, he was being educated at the time that all of this was going on. And there was this fresh desire to get back to the sources, discover what the ancients said, learn these original languages. And there was a flowering of scholarship that was taking place. Martin Luther was much older than John Calvin. So when Calvin was 8 years old, Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door at the church at Wittenberg. So that just gives you a little bit of perspective there. Calvin had great respect for Luther. Agreed with him on many things. They could never come to agree on understanding of the sacraments, particularly the Lord's Supper. And they never met. Calvin and Luther never met. Although, you know, they did minister, even though Luther was older, they did overlap in terms of times when they were ministering. But they... I think they may have communicated, you know, indirectly. They may have communicated by letter, but they never actually saw each other face to face. But again, just to give the bigger Reformation picture, 1517, the 95 Theses for Luther, 1521, Luther is condemned at the Diet of Worms, 1525, Luther writes The Bondage of the Will. Note that that book was written in response to Erasmus. So Erasmus, the one who had created the first critical edition of the Greek New Testament, also was sort of a proponent of free will, sort of an extreme version of free will. And Martin Luther wrote his book, The Bondage of the Will, in response to Erasmus. But let's get back to Calvin. Calvin's father was a lawyer, and he had originally decided that he wanted his son John to study law and to be a lawyer as well. They were not a super wealthy family, but because his father served some very wealthy families, Calvin had some privileges. He had a pretty good education. He was sent off to a good university, and he went there to study the humanities with the idea of getting a law degree. And he excelled in all that he did, even though he wasn't apparently all that interested in this. He was pleasing his father. Somewhere through the process, his father decided he'd rather his son become a priest. And Calvin shifted his study from law to theology. And he did very well. But he was part of, you know, he was experiencing this humanist education, this going back to the sources. And the first book Calvin ever published was a commentary on a book by Seneca, De Clementia. So this is just a pagan classic work. And he studied this, and he published a commentary on that work. But about this time, the influence of the Reformation, he was in Paris, he was studying in Paris, and the influence of the Reformation was spreading. And Calvin had been exposed to it. And Calvin, you know, who was studying to be a priest, embraced the teachings of Lutheranism and what became Protestantism. And this was a dangerous thing in Paris. France was a Roman Catholic nation. And those who were being influenced by Protestantism sometimes could face some extreme danger, even possibly face losing their life. And Calvin was forced to flee Paris when he was identified as part of the Protestant movement. And it happened in part in an interesting way. There was a rector at the university named Nicholas Kopp who gave an address at a university. And it was really a promotion of Protestant views over against Roman Catholic views. And the scholarly consensus is that most likely Calvin authored that address for him, or at least worked very closely with him on that address. And Calvin was sort of outed as a Protestant, and as a result, had to flee Paris. Now, there's a very interesting episode that takes place in his life about this time, and we're going to come back. You may have heard of a guy named Servetus. We'll come back to Servetus in the timeline a little bit later. Servetus is a heretic, became a heretic. But back in this early stage, when Calvin had become known as a Protestant and had fled Paris, Servetus was a student in Paris, and he had a lot of questions. And he somehow got word to Calvin, "I'd like to meet with you. I'd like to ask you some of my questions." And so Calvin agreed, at risk, to secretly go back to Paris and to meet with Servetus just to try to share the gospel with him, just try to answer his questions and to clarify, you know, what these Protestant teachings were. And Servetus didn't show up, which to me is a fascinating one of those what if scenarios. What if Servetus had kept the appointment that he, after all, had made with Calvin? What if he would have been persuaded by Calvin and would not have gone down his heretical path? Well, in God's providence, that did not take place. And we'll come back to Servetus, who later on is going to figure prominently in Calvin's life. But it also shows you something of Calvin's heart. He had a heart for the truth. He wanted people to know the truth. And he was willing, even at some risk to himself, to go back to a place of danger just to try to help out a student who had, you know, was inquiring about the faith. Well, Calvin fled Paris, and he traveled around to several different places. During this time, he's engaged in his studies, and he writes the first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion. This is an English translation of the first edition of the Institutes of Christian Religion, 1536. So Calvin's about 27 years old. And it's something of a systematic theology. It's very Trinitarian in its emphasis. It emphasizes God's means of grace. It includes an exposition of the Apostles' Creed, an exposition of the Lord's Prayer. But it was written not just for students. It was written to be helpful to all. Here's the full title. Back then, books had long titles. Institutes of the Christian Religion, embracing almost the whole sum of piety and whatever is necessary to know of the doctrine of salvation, a work most worthy to be read by all persons zealous for piety, and recently published. He wrote this for all people, that they might learn what they need to know in order to be saved and in order to serve Christ. Now, I'm going to read you, this is the first paragraph, because Calvin's Institutes is really a pretty accessible work. It's quite readable, but, and often people have such a negative caricature of Calvin. Well, here's the first paragraph in this book. It's under the heading, The Knowledge of God. Nearly the whole of sacred doctrine consists in these two parts, knowledge of God and of ourselves. Surely we ought for the present to learn the following things about God: to hold with sure faith, first, that he is infinite, that he is infinite wisdom, righteousness, goodness, mercy, truth, power, and life. And all these things, wherever seen, come from him. Secondly, that all things in heaven and on earth have been created for his glory, to serve him for his nature's sake alone, to keep his rule, accept his majesty, and in obedience recognize him as Lord and King. All this is due him by right. Thirdly, that he is himself a just judge, and therefore is going to take harsh vengeance upon those who have turned aside from his precepts, who have not followed his will through all things, who think, say, and do things other than those that pertain to his glory. Fourthly, that he is merciful and gentle, ready to receive the miserable and poor that flee to his mercy and put their trust in him, prepared to spare and pardon if any ask a favor of him, willing to succor and give aid if any ask for help, willing to save any who put all their trust in him and cleave to him. I really like that fourth point. I mean, magnifying the mercy and the grace of God. The best way to be delivered of some of the straw men views of Calvin is to read Calvin. I commend him to you. It's very good. Very good book and accessible. Some wonderful things about prayer. But at the age of 27, he publishes this book, which becomes very influential, and he becomes somewhat known as a result. His desire is to be a scholar. He wants a place of quiet rest where he can dedicate himself to study and to writing and publishing that will be a help to the church. And he's trying to get to Strasbourg to do that. But because of some political and military problems, he has to kind of take a circuitous route that takes him through Geneva, the town of Geneva in Switzerland. He stops in Geneva for one night, you know. I mean, he just, you know, shows up at the Hilton or whatever. And he's going to have one night in Geneva. But he's recognized, and word is given to William Farrell. Now, Farrell is the leading Protestant leader in Geneva. Geneva has already declared for the Reformation. It's already a Protestant city, and Farrell has begun the work of reform, but it's a huge work. He hears that Calvin is in town, and he rushes over there and begs Calvin to stay and to join him in the work of reformation in Geneva. To which Calvin says, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going on to Strasbourg. I'm going to do my study. Good luck. I mean, I'm sure he didn't. Calvin wouldn't say good luck, would he? At which point, Farrell says that he is going to pray down the curse of God on all of Calvin's studies if Calvin refuses to answer this call. And Calvin took it very seriously. And Calvin changed his mind. And Calvin, instead of staying one night in Geneva, ended up staying quite a lengthy period of time before he was expelled. But we'll come to that. Interesting how God works in his providence. Man plans his steps, but man plans the way the Lord directs his steps. He used an unusual approach by William Farrell to keep Calvin there. And so they joined together and were engaged in seeking further reform in the city of Geneva. Calvin had a very distinctive vision, and the city fathers were really not up for it. Calvin especially wanted a strong view of church discipline tied to the sacraments that would have some measure of social control in the town, and eventually the political leaders had enough. And so they expelled both Calvin and Farrell from Geneva. They were expelled together. And Calvin finally went to Strasbourg. So from 1536 into 1538, I think it was about, I can't remember exactly how many months, but a little less than 2 years he was in Geneva. Calvin goes to Strasbourg, and there he meets the various reformers there, most notably Martin Bucer. Martin Bucer is one of my heroes of the Reformation. He was a very ironic figure. He sought to have contact with the various reformers, work for unity, work for peace. He was very committed to a very orderly, biblical service of worship. Calvin learned a great deal about worship under the tutelage of Martin Bucer. And what Calvin did was he pastored a French congregation there. Remember, France was bitterly opposed officially to Protestantism, and so there were lots of refugees, religious refugees. Some of them made their way later on to Geneva, but a number of them were in Strasbourg. And so while that was a German-speaking area, and Bucer was pastoring and preaching in German, Calvin took up the role of pastoring a congregation of French refugees there. And it's a very fruitful time for Calvin. He publishes an expanded edition of the Institutes. He publishes a commentary on Romans. Interestingly, Cardinal Sadoleto, a Roman Catholic cardinal, was causing problems in Geneva. And Geneva, the city fathers, asked Calvin, could you write a reply for us? So even though they kicked him out of town, they realized he was one of the sharpest guys around. And Calvin did. And he wrote this little, I've got on bookshelf, this little reply to Cardinal Sadoleto. On behalf of Geneva, Calvin responded, defending the Reformation distinctives over against this Roman Catholic cardinal. And then very significantly, he married in Strasbourg. He was in his early 30s. And he married Idalette de Boer in Strasbourg in 1540. But in 1541, the City Council of Geneva invited Calvin to return. And they were much more open to his ideas at this point. Things had not been going well for them. They realized that Calvin was the one that could really make a difference. When Calvin was in Strasbourg, basically, and he and his wife were running a kind of boarding house for theological students. They didn't have a very private married life. They had this kind of boarding house, and it was largely on Idalette's shoulders to sort of run this thing as they housed students that were studying there for the ministry. One of the things that that pleased her greatly about Geneva, she wasn't anxious to leave Strasbourg. She'd been there so much of her life. But the city fathers actually gave them a very nice house that they could live in by themselves. She had a little vegetable garden in the back. And it turned out to be a delightful place just for her and for their marriage to be in Geneva. Calvin came. One of Calvin's distinctives that was a distinctive of several others in the Reformation was that he believed in expository preaching through books of the Bible. That's become very common in Presbyterianism. That's part of our heritage. Rather than following a lectionary that says, well, this week you preach on this text and this week on this, and they jump all around according to the church calendar, Calvin was preaching straight through books of the Bible. Well, he had been doing that in Geneva before he was kicked out. And when he came back and he took up preaching again, he says, well, I pick up where we left off last time, which was like 2.5 years earlier. And he just continued writing I forget which book it was, but I mean, he just picked up right where he left off. He preached generally about 5 times a week. He was phenomenal in his output. I don't know if you see these brown books down here, but this is his commentary. He wrote commentaries on most books of the Bible, not quite all, but most books of the Bible. People would transcribe his sermons. A number of his sermons have been published. Tremendous, tremendous output. We're going to stick with Calvin, so we'll skip over a few things here. In 1549, his wife, Idalette, dies. In 1553, Servetus, remember Servetus? Servetus, the student who had asked Calvin to come meet with him to have this discussion about theology, Servetus, who didn't show up. Subsequently, Servetus had become one of the most notorious heretics in Europe. And while people look down on Calvin, and we'll get to that in a minute, Servetus was basically a wanted man in just about every town, whether it was Roman Catholic or Protestant. He was anti-Trinitarian, so he was as much a heretic for the Catholics as he was for the Protestants. It was really just a matter of time before things caught up to Servetus, because at that day and age, a convicted heretic was going to be executed, which makes it strange that he decided to come to Geneva and just show up in church one day and sit down in the pews as Calvin was preaching, and he was immediately identified, he was recognized, and there ensued a lengthy trial. Calvin was one of the leaders of the prosecution against him, obviously, as the leading theological light in town. He was accused of heresy, and he was convicted and sentenced to death. Calvin did plead that they would give him a merciful form of death, which the city council did not do. And so I think he was burned. Burned at the stake. Calvin wanted something more merciful like beheading. So yes, Calvin was involved in his prosecution. This would have happened basically probably in any town, anywhere. He was a heretic. This is what happened to heretics. Calvin did call for some leniency. It was not it was not granted to him. And this is what Calvin has been tarred and feathered with ever since. So anything, you know, anytime if someone's an anti-Calvinist, apart from theological distinctives, they're almost always going to mention Servetus. And I don't think we can completely whitewash Calvin here. I mean, he was involved in this, but you do need to understand that this would have happened pretty much anywhere. The Roman Catholics would have executed him. Any other Protestant town would have executed him. This is the way heretics were treated in the 16th century. And Servetus was a genuine heretic, denying the Trinity as well as a number of other fundamental Christian teachings. So I do think we should have a certain measure of grace toward Calvin in this. The issues were real. I think the conviction was based on accuracy and truth and what Servetus believed and how it departed from Scripture. And it's simply a fact of the times that this is what happened to heretics. It has become just a stain in the reputation of Calvin that is hard for him. It's hard to overcome. Skipping down to 1559, Calvin publishes his final edition of the Institutes. This was the first edition. This is the final edition. He did quite a bit of expansion of the Institutes, and it's just a theological treasure, and again, accessible. But Calvin kept working on it. You know, he had, I don't know, three or four major editions. Scholars say he really never changed any of his fundamental theological convictions, but he treated more subjects, and he expanded his treatment of subjects, and he reorganized the Institutes themselves. But it's not like you're going to find later Calvin in big disagreement with earlier Calvin. It's not the case at all. He just was committed to this project, and he was trying to perfect it as he went. 1564, Calvin dies. So that's kind of a quick overview of the life of Calvin. Now what I want to do is run, and I'm going to have to run, through a little bit of John Knox. When it comes to especially Presbyterianism, distinctively, Knox and the Scottish Church are really our direct heritage. Calvin influenced many people, so Presbyterianism is one stream that traces back to Calvin, and Calvin did basically have, you know, a Presbyterian form of church government. It wasn't a great emphasis of his, but where that took root and flourished was Scotland. And the link between Geneva and Scotland was John Knox, and the primary carrier of the message from Calvin was Knox. Again, Knox was just born 4 years after Calvin, so they were roughly contemporaries. And if you follow the timeline all the way back up to 1547, I have Knox becomes a preacher at St. Andrew's Castle. Now, Knox had gone to university, had studied to be a priest, and he had studied theology. He was ordained to the priesthood, but he was never given. There was a glut of priests in Scotland at that time. There was no need for him in a particular parish. And so while he was ordained as a priest, he actually ended up working as a notary. He had also had some legal training. And he was working as a notary. He was serving, I think, as a tutor for some sort of minor nobility. But he had his ear to the ground for what was going on theologically. And George Wissert was a traveling preacher, and he traveled in part because if he stayed put, he probably would have died sooner than he did die. He would travel around Scotland, and he was proclaiming the truths of the Protestant faith. And he attracted a group of followers who served as his bodyguards. And John Knox was a bodyguard for George Wissert, this traveling preacher. And Knox carried a two-handed sword as a bodyguard. So he's a pretty cool guy, pretty tough guy. He's traveling around with his two-handed sword, this big sword, to be sort of the part of the protection detail for this Protestant preacher. And they would literally show up at a church and take over the service and just preach. Then they'd go to another town and they would do the same thing. Well, the Roman Catholic authorities were not happy, of course, with George Wissert and his traveling band. And Wissert realized that his end was probably drawing near, that they probably were going to get him. His archenemy was Cardinal Beaton, and he realized that he was in Beaton's. So he told his followers, I want you to go. I want you to don't follow me anymore for your own security, for the future of the church. You leave me alone. And very soon after that, he was arrested, and he was executed under the oversight of Cardinal Beaton. At which point, some of his followers viciously murdered Cardinal Beaton and took a very revolutionary approach to reform. that would have a lot of negative consequences. Needless to say, they were wanted men. Knox was not among them. Knox was not a party to the attack on Cardinal Beaton. He had no direct involvement with it. But after that, some of these wanted men kind of holed up in St. Andrew's Castle. And John Knox, at times the castle was under siege, at times it wasn't. And one of the times that it wasn't, John Knox decided to visit them and sort of began to live among them. And they decided that he was called to be a preacher. This wasn't his desire necessarily at that point. But one of them was preaching on the call to ministry and basically said, you know, you need to be our pastor. It wasn't an ordinary way to be appointed. You know, this wasn't coming officially from the church, and yet in the extreme circumstances, after prayer, Knox determined that it was a legitimate call to accept a call to become a pastor to these folks. They were known as the Castilians because they were in the castle. And so just as, you know, God used William Farrell, to get Calvin to stay in Geneva, he used this kind of irregular call to pastoral ministry for Knox, and Knox accepted, and he began preaching at St. Andrew's. But he was also there when the castle was attacked, and he was taken. It was the French Roman Catholic forces were the ones that were coming in, and he was captured and became a slave on galley ships. You know, if you ever seen Ben-Hur, you know those ships where you've got six guys on an oar. The ships in Knox's day, six guys on an oar. And if you're under sail, fine. But if the wind died down, you guys had to row. Many people died. Knox didn't write a lot about it, but he did say that, you know, he did make clear that the conditions were pretty miserable. But he survived that. He served as a galley slave and was released in 1549, perhaps through a request of the English king at that time. Skipping down to 1556, so Knox is delivered, and what he does is he spends the next 5 years in England. England now is under a Protestant king, and he serves at the behest of the king in England, serving as a pastor. He was involved in the revision of the Second Book of Common Prayer. So he had a very effective ministry for 5 years in England. But then Catholic Bloody Mary Tudor ascends to the throne, and he's forced to flee to the continent. He goes to France, he goes to Geneva, he goes to Zurich, he ends up in Frankfurt am Main, where he pastors a church of English exiles. This is what's happening in this day, okay? This is when, if the Roman Catholics take control of the country, a bunch of Protestants flee. They're overseas, they have their own church in their own language. And so he was pastoring a church in Frankfurt for English exiles and developed a liturgy, developed a lot of views of worship that became influential later on in Presbyterianism. But eventually, he finds his way to Geneva. He pastors an English congregation in Geneva. Note, this is 1556. Calvin doesn't die till 1564. They become friends. Knox is very influenced by Calvin. John Knox said this of Geneva in the time of Calvin: "It is the most perfect school of Christ that ever was in the earth since the days of the apostles." Now, whether that's true or not, that was Knox's view. Knox was extremely impressed by the way in which the Protestant faith was being lived out in Geneva, not just in the preaching, but influencing the culture. And his vision was for a culture being renewed by the true faith. And that was his desire when he went back to Scotland. However, he was not nearly as temperate as Calvin was. And if Calvin has Servetus hanging around his neck, Knox has the charge of misogyny hanging around his neck, due in large part to the book he published entitled The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. This was written to make the case biblically that it was unbiblical for a female to reign as sovereign in a nation. And this was brought on by Bloody Mary. So he wrote this to say it's unbiblical to have a queen at all. You cannot have a female sovereign. This is unbiblical. You have to understand the monstrous regiment. The word monstrous just literally means unnatural. And regiment just means rule. So the first blast of the trumpet against the unnatural rule or government of women. And I mean, he makes his case. It was a political miscalculation on Knox's part. Because just a few months after Mary dies, Elizabeth I ascends to the throne in England. She's a Protestant. She's in favor of the Protestants. She can't stand John Knox because she falls just as much under his criticism as Mary does because why? Well, she's a female ruler. And so, big miscalculation because what he was seeking to use against an anti-Protestant queen came back to bite him when a Protestant queen took the throne. And he continued to be very, very influential. He returns to Scotland in 1559. He's involved in publishing the Scots Confession in 1560. He's probably the primary author along with a few others. I was going to read an excerpt. I don't have time to read some excerpts. But one of the fascinating things about the Scots Confession is it unfolds a lot of the doctrine in the order of the events in Scripture, what we call redemptive history, kind of thing I like to talk about in Scripture, you know, the way everything flows. And so he talks about creation, then he talks about the fall, and then he talks about God's promise of salvation. It's a very rich approach to theology. And Knox then serves out his days as a preacher in Edinburgh. He had a temper, wasn't always the nicest guy to get along with. He was a preacher for all those years. He only ever published two sermons. He published a history of the Reformation. He published some other things that we have. But tremendously influential in the birthing of Presbyterianism and the Reformed faith in Scotland. And we're just going to have to very quickly say that then in the next century, that Scottish Presbyterianism was to have a huge influence through the Westminster Assembly of Divines, a gathering of pastor theologians that was called by Parliament in England, called initially to reform the Church of England. The first call of the Westminster Assembly was to revise the 39 Articles, which is the confessional document of the Anglican Church. They'd actually worked on 15 of them before their charge was changed because of the signing of what's called the Solemn League and Covenant, which was a document that aimed to unite and reform the religion in the three kingdoms of England, Ireland, and Scotland. So now, instead of just reforming the Church of England, it was unite all of them. And by the way, the Church of Scotland was going to be the model that they were going to follow. And so in addition to about 120 English theologians, they invited about eight Scottish guys down. And those Scottish pastor theologians had a huge influence on the writing of the Westminster Confession, Catechisms, Directory for Church Government, Directory for Public Worship, making it much more Presbyterian in its distinctives. But the vagaries of politics changed so that the Westminster standards never took hold in England, which went back to the Church of England, the Anglican Church. But they did take hold in Scotland, and Scotland became officially a Presbyterian country. Presbyterianism became the established church of Scotland. And from Scotland, it spread to our shores. So that's a whirlwind tour of this. But I hope it gives you some indication of some of the key figures that we as Presbyterians look back to. Calvin is sort of a fountainhead. Knox is that conduit into Scotland and the development of more Presbyterian emphases. And that being sort of codified in the 17th century in the Westminster Assembly and in the documents that they produced, which are still, in its confession, larger catechism, and shorter catechism, the confessional documents of our denomination, the Presbyterian Church in America.